I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. The week of September 17th, 2024. Medical waste and other garbage wash up on mid-Atlantic shores in Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, closing down the beaches, but no one quite knows what happened. The Washington, D.C. Auditor's Office releases a bombshell report that there is no police officer shortage in the city, bucking the national narrative on police staffing. And three fourth graders join us to talk about their campaign to get the red-backed salamander to become Washington, D.C.'s official amphibian. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program. If your goal is to make a meaningful impact with a career in local, state, or federal government, discover what this degree can do for you. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaracina on guitar and vocals, Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals, Evan Hurd on bass, and Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends. Last Sunday morning, September 15th, plastic trash began to wash ashore on Atlantic Ocean beaches from Delaware to Virginia. There were sanitary napkins, cigarette butts, but also medical use needles. Ocean City, Maryland, the town of Fenwick in Delaware, Assateague State Park, and the Assateague National Seashore, and others all closed their beaches to swimming and limited walking access on the sand. A few hours later, the debris began to arrive at Chincoteague Shore in Virginia. It seemed that the trash was floating north to south. But officials from the coastal towns and the states of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia do not yet know where the trash may be coming from. Coastal shipping traffic in the U.S. includes shiploads of garbage being moved from big urban areas to landfills up and down the coast. But there have been no reports of capsized trash barges. Officials are calling it medical waste because of the needles, but it is more likely household waste dumping. Medical waste is considered to be hazmat and generally burned, not transported far away, and certainly not by sea. By midday Monday, September 16th, the flow of debris had slowed but continues, and the beaches remain closed. The cleanup and investigation work remain. Assateague State Park and Assateague National Seashore officials say that the rest of the park remains open to visitors on the chance you want to visit. We'll be following the story. Since the pandemic, but going further back, a big part of the public safety narrative in the national media and now in the presidential race is around the shortage of police officers. The argument is that police departments are hemorrhaging staff. Few, except the truly committed, want to deal with unsupportive political environments in which police departments are said to have to operate following the defund movements of the last decade. Officer shortage arguments prevail in Maryland, Virginia, and almost all states. They prevail in counties, including in Montgomery, where it is said that police officers would rather work for municipal police forces, such as the cities of Rockville and Gaithersburg, but do not want to work for the county itself. Now, a report from the Washington, D.C. Auditor's Office finds that the Metropolitan Police Department in the city is in fact not short on officers. They don't have a staffing problem. They have an allocation problem instead. As of October 1st, 2023, the D.C. Police Department had 4,000 allocated positions, roughly 1,900 for patrolling, 460 in investigations, and the rest to different functions. The D.C. auditor found that the 2023 patrol officer strength of 1,340 was adequate and that the department did not need another 600 patrol officers based on public safety needs and 911 calls for service. But the study did find that MPD officers were poorly assigned. For example, there were too many officers on the midnight shift and too few in the day and evening shifts, and that the 3rd and 7th districts were understaffed while other police districts were overstaffed. The study also found that the Investigative Services Bureau, which is the division responsible for investigating most crime in the city, is 65 officers short at 340 officers. The biggest shortage is in the Criminal Investigations Division's District Detectives Unit. Based on the volume and nature of cases, the 3rd, 6th, and 7th districts need the most additional detectives. DC police have rejected the auditor's report and have said that the last 5 years of overtime patterns suggest the need for 500 or more officers. The DC auditor's report said that MPD did not provide supporting evidence. This debate is playing out in police departments across the nation. In Montgomery County, Maryland, there is an internal debate in the police department over handing the internal affairs function, the department's in-house watchdog division, entirely to civilians, which would release sworn officers for detective and patrol work. There is debate over shifting police district boundaries to better equalize workload, moving, for example, a portion of the 4th District in Wheaton into the 1st District in Rockville. The County Council has recommended a police staffing study. Stay tuned, as this issue will keep bouncing back. You may know that the 10-year-old Chesapeake Bay Watershed Agreement that includes 7 states from New York to Virginia is up for renewal this year. And the Chesapeake Bay program, which was set up 40 years ago, has asked for public comments as part of the renewal process. The agreement is likely to be renewed, but the details are interesting. Last month, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, released data that 5 of the 7 states will not meet their pollution diet numbers. Apart from D.C. and West Virginia, the other jurisdictions continue to send significantly higher agricultural runoff into the Chesapeake. Pennsylvania, which does not front any part of the bay, is the worst performing. I called Jeremy Cox of the Chesapeake Bay Journal, who has been wading through 266 pages of public comments to try to get a sense of where we are going.
Progress has been frustratingly slow in cutting these nutrients, in part because we have a rising population within the watershed. More people means more pollution, and climate change is kind of throwing a wrench in the works, warming the water, causing more frequent storms, more stormwater pollution. The Bay program has enjoyed very strong, sustained support throughout the years. And even in the face of faltering progress and a little frustration over that, I don't see any signs that anyone wants to burn down the house and start over again. Agriculture is the number one place where we need to get, where the Bay Program needs to get the biggest cuts going forward in sediment and nutrient pollution. Every little farm needs its own plan, needs to have a way to deal with the nutrients that they're and sediment that they're creating. And that's an enormous thing to do. And they've, to the Bay Program's effort and the state's efforts, they've made a tremendous amount of progress, but it's just such a big issue. And some places are further behind. Pennsylvania, it's going to take many, many years, decades, if we stay on the same track we're at, to get to the pollution goals that we're trying to reach. Rarely do you see much in the way of enforcement, especially at the individual farm level. Enforcement mechanism is not much. You go out with a paper cup and you scoop the ditch out once in a while, and you do a visual test of it, generally, is what it comes down to. So it's self-monitoring.
There isn't a legal mechanism to enforce.
The EPA actually has a little bit of an enforcement, some teeth there. It can act as a backstop, they call it. And so if you are failing, if you as a state or as a District of Columbia are failing to meet your goals, they can come in and start, say, okay, we're going to cut your funding.
As I read the public comments, I didn't see any real focus on K-12 education. In the 266 pages, there were 17 mentions of education. Of them, I think 10 were in some, people's signature. There's very little emphasis on education.
You talk about environmental literacy. I think funding has been pretty solid for that in the last recent years. And there are a lot of on the ground efforts out there. Chesapeake Bay Foundation, kind of the largest environmental group dedicated to the Bay for more than 40 years, has been doing outdoor education program and has actual permanent, sites out in the Bay that people can visit. And they bring teachers, they bring students out there.
The Chesapeake Bay Watershed Agreement is signed in the end by the governors. The choices here are, in fact, political.
The government is if it's afraid of anything, it's afraid of, getting sued by the EPA and having to go through all that. And that'll be the big question going forward when the executive council, the governors, when they meet in December to vote on this framework of an agreement, what version will it be? Because it'll have to go through those the panel with the senior state officials, the heads of the environmental programs. And we're going to see what appetite they have for change versus staying the course, but not getting, you're more assured of steering clear of the ire of the EPA.
Jeremy Cox, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. Good to be here.
Few stories demonstrate the importance of environmental education than the next one. DC fourth graders Max Gershek, Milo Evans Snyder, and Davi Kurasi Diamond of Powell Elementary School in the city are on the verge of getting a DC law passed that will designate the redback salamander as the city's official amphibian. Can you describe the redback salamander?
It is small. It's 4 inches long, and it's pretty slimy. It doesn't bite.
You just told me earlier that when you hold it in your hand, be careful, you may dry it out. Yes. Why is that?
It's because it breathes through its skin, so when you hold it in your hands, it basically just suffocates it. So it's like if you were trapped in sand, like up to your head.
That doesn't sound good. Why did you decide that the redback salamander should be DC's official amphibian?
Well, they're scattered all over of DC. Nobody really notices them. and there in no other state or country has the Redback Salamander as their amphibian.
Do you know if the Redback Salamander is somewhat unique to the Washington, D.C. area, or is this everywhere?
Well, it depends which one you're talking about. There's the Western Redback Salamander, and there's the Eastern Redback Salamander. The Eastern one is the one we're trying to designate. So across the Eastern coast, all the way up to Canada.
Now, when did you make up your mind to do this?
During 2020, my family formed a pod with Max's family, and we kept on going on a bunch of hikes in Rock Creek Park, and we looked for like bugs and small animals under logs and rocks, and we kept on finding the Redback Salamander. So then we learned more and more about it, and Max's mom thought, well, if no other state has a Redback Salamander as theirs, why don't we do it?
And then what did you do?
A couple of years later, we told our council member about the Redback Salamander, and then she helped us a lot. The chairman and the council member came to Powell School, and the chairman said, "I'll give you a hearing. But I have to say, I have an affinity for toads." It was perfect.
So you all go to the same school?
Yes.
Which is that?
Powell Elementary School.
Powell Elementary. Okay. And who is your council member who is so supportive?
Janice Lewis George.
Yeah.
Okay. And the chair is Chair Phil Mendelson, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So next week, you're going to have a hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you planning to speak there?
Yeah. Yes,
we are planning to speak there.
What are you going to say?
We're going to say stuff about like when we first found it, and we're going to say why it should be the official amphibian, and like things about how abundant it is. And yeah.
My testimony is like, gonna like say the story of how we got to this point, and then I'm gonna pass it on to everyone else.
Davi, what are you going to say?
Well, I'm gonna say a lot of stuff about the salamanders too, like why we want the Redback Salamander to be the official amphibian, why it means a lot to you, and what are your good school and how old you are.
Also, you're learning another important lesson about how government works.
Yeah.
What did you learn?
A lot of other states have to do four processes. So DC is not a state, so we have to do six. The council members have to vote on the bill twice. And yeah.
So if DC is not a state, how does it affect you? Do you know?
If DC is not a state, it affects us because we don't have all the same rights that all of the states have. It makes it harder for us to do things that places like
Washington.
Washington and like Philadelphia and all the states can do.
Now, I believe you put together a petition. How did you do that?
Well, I just wrote petition for Redback Salamander. And then I went to school. We all walked around the building asking for signatures, and we got a lot of them.
How many signatures did you get?
We have not counted, like maybe 76 or 80.
When is the hearing?
The hearing is next Wednesday, which is
September 18th, yeah.
Do they vote that day, the council?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, guys. Good work. Good luck. I'll be watching.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting us.
Yeah. Come again next time.
That's Max Gershik, Milo Evans-Snyder, and Davi Karasi-Diamond fourth graders in Powell Elementary School in DCPS. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that comes out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals. Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals. Evan Hurd on bass. And Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends.